Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps, sitting in for Jim Fleming. Maybe it's because compared to some, we're a relatively young nation, but we Americans always seem to be in such a hurry to change. Lose weight, run a marathon, learn to meditate, or find life's purpose. It's as though we're all secretly terrified of running out of time, of getting stuck.
I was stuck in my sculpture. I was 62 at the time, and I kept wondering, what is this age thing all about? How do you get up every morning and keep the juices flowing? And it just occurred to me, I need to speak to some older people.
In this hour, talking with older people about change over time. Father Thomas Keating spent decades transforming himself through rigorous spiritual practice. Change is a lifelong endeavor, he says, and it's worth every minute.
You can't help but see how much in oneself has to change in the way of attitudes, dispositions. Spiritual consolation is so strong that you can take all the other pleasures of the world and put them in the wastebasket without even noticing it.
Also, a look back at the second career of the English writer Thomas Hardy. He didn't publish his first volume of poetry until his 60s.
I mean, it's a very curious career. 30 years as a novelist, establishing himself with a world reputation as a major 19th century novelist, and he stops writing novels. And he has 30 years, almost, in the 20th century, as a 20th century poet. If you think about that, no other writer can parallel, can equal that.
But what about people for whom change and time are unbearable?
I imagine time as some kind of a monster that was devouring the seconds and minutes of our days and bringing us closer to the end. So around the age of 6 or 7 was when perhaps the anxiety started.
But first, Carl Honoré on changing your life by slowing it down. Honoré is known as the unofficial godfather of the slowness movement, a worldwide campaign that took off after Honoré wrote a book called In Praise of Slowness. It started when a group of Italian chefs embraced the concept of slow food. Today, slow is a philosophy that's gone far beyond food.
I talk about it as a cultural revolution, if you like, and I know that those are very big words, but I think that they're apt here. It seems to me that if you go back to the end of the 19th century, when the culture of acceleration really got into full swing, you had the emergence of the futurists, for instance, in Italy, who glorified speed, who talked about the beauty of speed, that speed became an end in itself. You go to the end of the 20th century, and it seems to me we've come out the other end of that upward curve of acceleration, where we're saying to ourselves now, right across the planet, at every socioeconomic level, people are saying, you know what, speed is great, you know, speed is good, it has a lot to offer, but it's not always the best policy, and that it's time to remember that slow has a role to play, that slow is a good thing, and we need to reconnect with our inner tortoise, if you like. And I think that the 20th century was all about unleashing our inner hare. Now it's time for the tortoise to come up alongside the hare so that we have both. We have moments when we're fast, and we have moments when we're slow. And really what slow is about, when you drill down to the bottom of it, is about doing things at the right speed and doing things at what the musicians call the tempo giusto, the correct tempo or pace that every moment or person or activity has.
You first brought the beginning slowness movement to the public's attention with a book you wrote 5 years ago or so. How's it changed in the intervening time?
Well, it's been an extraordinary ride, and it's just astonishing to me how many different ways around the world people are taking this idea of slow and finding ways to apply it to, you know, the blossoming of movements like slow design, slow fashion, slow parenting, slow travel is huge at the moment. And it's extraordinary, really. It's really quite inspiring to think that this is, I mean, it's a paradox in a way that the slow movement is growing so fast. but in a way, that's good fast. That's what we're talking about here, that there are moments of, you know, good slow and bad slow, and there are moments of good fast and bad fast. And I'm relieved and pleased, I think, to see the slow movement growing strongly and people getting it.
So what are some of these new avenues of slowness that are opening up? You mentioned slow fashion, slow design. What are those?
Yeah, well, slow design is looking at how we make things, and that's every link in the chain. So when you're thinking, and again, this is coming back to the slow idea of what you do affects everything around you, the bigger picture. So something that's slow design is about making it with products that you know, don't harm the environment, or maybe they're fair traded on an economic level with the people you're acquiring the raw materials from. And then they're made in a way that they're designed not to be disposable and throwaway. They may even be products that encourage people to slow down, you know, a big comfortable bench that you place in a waiting room or something. So people are bringing this idea of also the creative impulse that we have as human beings is very much allied to slowness, because it's when the brain is in a relaxed state that the brain waves begin to move out in richer, more nuanced, more creative patterns. And that's when you get those eureka moments. So slow design is also about taking a deep breath and letting things happen, you know, letting that inventive spark occur and then going with it at the right speed and so on, and making things not necessarily on a huge industrial scale, but maybe making them on a smaller scale.
You mentioned slow parenting. What's that?
Well, I think that's taking the same slow idea and applying it to child rearing. I think that the virus of hurry has infected the way we think about children, and you see it in the school system where kids are crammed with academic learning younger and younger and then tested over and over and over again, homework piled high, and of course technology. I mean, children wired from the moment they're out of the womb. You've got them being placed in front of screens to watch baby TV or baby Einstein DVDs and so on. And I think there's a wealth of evidence that suggests that that is not the best way for children to develop. And so the slow philosophy comes to bear in the sense of saying, well, it's about finding a balance. Some technology is fine, and of course you have to give children a push from now and again, but they also need slowness. In fact, I think children probably need slowness more than adults do, because it's in those unstructured, free play moments that kids learn how to think creatively, how to invent, how to get along with each other. It's when they learn how to take pleasure from things, and it's when they learn, maybe most importantly of all, who they are rather than what we want them to be. You know, understand that each child has his or her own tempo giusto, you know, their own rhythm, and some children will be late bloomers and others will learn things at different rates. The childhood should not be a rat race. It's not a dash to a finish line. It's much more complex and blurry and fuzzy, and in the end, much more thrilling and enriching because of that, I think. It's not full speed ahead.
Now, another aspect of the worldwide slow movement is slow travel.
Yes, that's something you're seeing a lot of now. And that's the reaction against the fast-forward approach to travel, where you hop on a plane, you fly somewhere, you do 50 things, you have lunch, you fly back the next day, and you've just passed through in a blur and also taken a heavy toll on the environment as well. And slow travel is about taking some of that heat out of the way we move around the world. And so it can start with how you get from A to B. Rather than jumping on a plane, maybe you take a bus or cycle, or obviously not all destinations that works for, but you enjoy the journey as much as the destination, because that's another part of slow. It's about appreciating getting from A to B rather than instantly wanting always to be at B. So slow travel is about enjoying the trip, the anticipation, the build-up, looking forward to arriving in the place. And then when you actually arrive at the place, not overstuffing your schedule and trying to see every single site listed in the tourist guides, but maybe picking two or three and spending time there, just sitting on a bench, soaking up the architecture or listening to the local voices and taking in the smells, and also having a more real and local experience, because so much of what our fast-forward culture is about is the rubbing away of local wrinkles. You go everywhere now and there's a Gap, there's a Starbucks, everything is the same, the same hotel chains. And I guess slow travel is about finding the unique, ungoogleable, if you like, the fine grain of a place. And that takes time to find those details, because when you're rushing through, everything becomes a blur. It's when you slow down that you really engage. It's really when you have those moments, those sometimes very small, simple, even free moments that burn themselves into your memory and become lifetime memories to look back on. So there's been a big push for slow travel in the United States, but around the world, and people rethinking how we get around the planet and what we make of the places when we actually get there. And of course, as an addendum to that, with the skyrocketing price of fuel now, you're finding that planes are flying more slowly to conserve energy, and buses are traveling more slowly, and people are driving more slowly. And so there's almost a kind of compulsion now to slow down. The system is forcing us to slow down. So I think that's an interesting little bit of grit in the argument now, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, if people chafe against that and find it really irritating, or if it helps them, if it guides them into seeing the joys of taking things a little bit more slowly, traveling a bit more slowly.
How has the slow movement and your interest in it changed your own lifestyle. What does slowness look like when you put it into practice?
It's a funny thing, actually. On the surface, you might think that I haven't slowed down at all because I travel and I write and I talk. I have a full life, but actually when you inhabit my life, it feels very different. There's a very clear before and after for me. Before, I was always trying to do more and more things more and more quickly. I never said no to anything. Whereas today, I still do a lot of things, but I don't do too many things. And I always try and give, wherever possible, the time that each thing deserves. It's funny, it's a hard thing to measure, but I used to feel constantly worried about the time and feel rushed. I almost never feel that way anymore. And the irony is that I seem to get a lot more done, which is the beauty of slow, is that often slow is a lot more productive than fast.
Carl Honoré is the unofficial godfather of the worldwide slowness movement. His first book on the subject was In Praise of Slowness. His most recent, on slow parenting, is called Under Pressure, and he's the founder of the Slow Planet website. We're taking the long view of personal change in this hour, from slowing down the pace of life to celebrating the long life. Our next guest is Amy Gorman. She's the author of the book Aging Artfully and of a multimedia project called Arts and Longevity. It began as a series of profiles of women in the arts, storytellers, painters, actors, musicians, all of them between the ages of 85 and 105. That led to a documentary film called Still Kicking. Gorman's inspiration grew out of her own artistic struggles and her search for older female role models.
It was really an organic process. I'm an amateur sculptor. I've been sculpting about 10 years, and I like to sculpt heads. So I suppose I like to explore profiles of people, both in 3D and through the written words, with clay. And simultaneously, I was stuck in my sculpture. And I woke up one morning and I had a dream. I woke up one morning and age was on my mind. Mm-hmm. I was 62 at the time and I kept wondering, what is this age thing all about? How do you get up every morning and keep the juices flowing? And it was at that time that I was stuck in my sculpture. I was on a plateau. And it just occurred to me, I need to speak to some older people, some older women artists. And so I mentioned it to my friend, Frances Candle, who is a composer and pianist, and she asked me if I knew Lily Hurst. She must be 100 by now, Frances said, and she plays the piano every day. And I said, Frances, she's 100. What are we waiting for? So we got together with Lily, and I was completely enamored with her. I just fell in love, and I knew I wanted more Lilies in my life. So I had no notion of writing a book at the time. But I did know that I had to search for other role models and glean what I could from their truths. So I looked for other Lilies and started the project.
Tell me about Lily, the first older artist you met.
Lily is a small, petite, finely sculpted person with skin very taut. And she was my first inspiration, and I'm ever grateful to her for that. She represents really the best of what we're learning older people are capable of doing in the arts, continuing to participate and expand as well as exhibit a discipline. She's from the old Viennese school. She certainly grew up with discipline and maintained it.
Scales and chords, 15 minutes at least, and the rest is my pieces every day, so I don't forget them. They are precious to me. You have to hold on. Everything goes, but the piano doesn't go away. That's forever. And I'm grateful for that.
And she did that until about 3 weeks before she died at 107.
That's part of what interested you in all of these women, isn't it? Women who had found, through whatever art form they practiced, a passion that really sort of stayed with them and was their great companion on into the, you know, sometimes the lonely years of old age.
That's true. And I think what's so remarkable, really, is that these women are not famous people. We don't know about them. They're artists in their own rights, for sure, but they're mostly ordinary people, many of whom developed an interest in art later in life, when they retired or even later than that. That's what I found so inspiring.
What did you learn from these women yourself? Are there particular lessons you've taken away from your conversations with them?
Oh, many. I hope I can use some of them if I'm lucky enough to get there. I think the biggest lesson is to not dwell on negative thoughts, not complain about what happened in the past. I think that's really important. Also, to never give up. These are platitudes. I think many people have heard them before, but still hearing them from people at this stage in their lives, in the 9th and 10th decade, it has a different meaning. I really feel that they have something to teach us. And I liked hearing them say to never give up. I like especially to not be afraid to try something new. Something we once loved to do but stopped doing, for example, or something entirely new. And what's really fascinating to me is all the current brain research, which points to the decrease in the fear factor as we age, which is great news for those of us who are thinking about aging. Our brain cells actually develop so as to allow us to feel less fear and negative emotion and feel more positive emotion.
That's very good news.
Yeah, it's great news. So you see that. People are not afraid to try things, and many of the women do various things. Isabel, for example, is a poet and a painter and an actor. What she wanted to do, she was about 85, and she said, I've never acted. I need to start acting. So here she is at 91, going to classes, doing acting and performing all over the place. She's fulfilling her dream.
Do you think knowing these women and seeing how engaged they are in their lives has changed for you your vision of what it means to age, what it will mean to be a much older woman?
Well, it's not so scary anymore. I have all these amazing role models, and that's really what I wanted to present to the public, these wonderful role models. Oh, I don't want to deny the difficulties of getting older and that people do decline physically and or cognitively. But we all know that lifespan is expanding, and many of us will get to 85. Not all of us, but some of us will. So I wanted to present some of the possibilities and potentials. And these women are just such great examples. They demonstrate what can happen. And it's not too early for people to think about what to do in your last several decades of life. I think it behooves us to prepare for some of it.
Amy Gorman is the author of Aging Artfully, profiles of visual and performing women artists age 85 to 105. We also heard an excerpt from Greg Norman's documentary, Still Kicking, about six of the women featured in the book. I'm Anne Strainchamps, sitting in for Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, from PRI, Public Radio International. Father Thomas Keating is one of the world's greatest living mystics. For decades, he lived an austere and fairly cloistered monastic life. Then he founded the Centering Prayer Movement as a form of contemplative outreach, a way of making contemplative practice accessible and available to everyone. Recently, Father Keating's been engaged in a series of interreligious dialogues with leaders of other faiths. He told Steve Paulson why he believes everyone should practice contemplative meditation.
to put it bluntly, to become God, not in the full theological sense, because theology deals with reason rather than experience. So the shadow side, as Jung calls it, of our personality emerges with a great deal of force after a while in that process, and you make yourself vulnerable through silent meditation.
Well, I would think that once you start doing this seriously, especially for a beginner, I would think that just spending all of that time in silence with your own thoughts...
Totally changed my life. I left whatever I was doing and entered a monastery, which was about as radical a thing. There were only three in this country at the time. And I deliberately chose it because it was an idea that if you really want to be a contemplative... best to choose the hardest life you can find.
And you became a Trappist monk, which
that was considered hard enough.
It's considered one of the most austere orders there is.
Yes, it's since been somewhat humanized and moderated since the Second Vatican Council, but it was radical. We got up 2 a.m. and 1 a.m. on feast days and about 6 or 7 hours of chanting of the offices, consisting of psalms and prayers, and then there was a lot of work.
Did that help you? I mean, just that austerity?
Well, the chief thing that helped me, because I had already started to, I was 2.5 or 3 years waiting to get in because I was too young to go it right away. And so during that time, I tried to bone up on being a monk as best I could in the world, to the great distress of my poor family who didn't know what the heck I was up to. It was really had a certain element of romance. I mean, what was I? I was 18, 19. And so I made several surreptitious visits to the monastery. It was like a tryst, really. The spiritual consolation is so strong that you can take all the other pleasures of the world and put them in the wastebasket without even noticing it.
Now, you are well known for the centering prayer. What led you to pursue this particular practice and to teach it to other people?
Well, it was a realization, you know, from my studies and practice and also my experience in the monastery. What really was significant about that is that you can't help but see how much in oneself has to change in the way of attitudes, dispositions. And there is a battle, a struggle between the dark side of one's personality. Paul calls it the old man. Well, with a little psychological tweak that might be more suitable to our time, I call it the false self. Merton used that term also. So it's the self that you don't even think of, at least I didn't, until you take the spiritual journey or the transformative process seriously. And in my day, and it was a mistake, the hardest life was supposed to help you to reach this. Well, I no longer believe that, but it took me 20 or 30 years to work through that mindset. And this is because the real focus or meaning or depth of contemplative tradition as a heritage in the Christian scheme of things was virtually lost for all practical purposes on the level of parish life where most people are, or even in Catholic schools or seminaries. And so there is this depth that contemplative prayer introduces one to. One moves beyond the false self to the true self, which is might also be called the spiritual level of our being.
How similar is this process you're describing to some of the meditative techniques that you find in some of the Eastern traditions, whether it's Buddhism or...
Well, a human being is pretty much the same in everybody. So similar methods, and the chief one is to develop some capacity for concentration and clarity of mind, because everybody is battered around in daily life.
Well, part of the reason why I asked the question about the similarities between the contemplative Christian tradition that you're describing and some of the Eastern traditions is that the metaphysical systems are really very different. I mean, with Buddhism, I mean, the obvious difference is this is not a theistic system. The life that you have chosen is very theistic. I mean, you weren't invoking God. You were invoking Jesus in particular. And I'm wondering, how similar the experience is once you get past the words that you use or the Buddhists use. I mean, do you think the experience itself, the spiritual experience, is pretty similar?
I do. I think there are remarkable similarities. I find that the contemplative dimension is not restricted to any one religion. We're talking about a God whom we all agree is absolute or infinite in every direction, who is sheer isness and beyond that, who is just plain being and existence and therefore is present in everything that exists. So it's no one religion could possibly fully communicate this mystery.
God is a word that's famously hard to talk about, to describe.
Choose anyone you like.
Well,
fine with me.
I'd love to have you, as best as you can, talk about what your image of God is, or who is God, or what is God. How would you describe this presence, this being, whatever God is?
Well, to do this well, you have to go to heaven, or at least die. But this Absolute, as it's called in Buddhism, is a good word. And in our interreligious dialogues that we had at the monastery in Snowmass, Colorado, we reached an agreement that we would call this reality that's called God in the Judeo-Christian tradition the ultimate reality. There was some discussion about calling it the ultimate mystery. Hence, anything you can say about God is a lie, strictly speaking. But since you need to say something or have some pointers towards the mystery, like Buddhism, you have the guy who had his finger pointed at the moon. But he didn't get enlightened until somebody cut his finger off, meaning there isn't anything to point to, because all that we want to say about God is already here within us at a level that is beyond any kind of articulation or experience.
One final question. There are more and more people now, secular people, who would say they don't believe in God, but who talk about experiencing the awe and wonder in nature in particular, and who talk about profound experiences there. And I'm wondering if you think what these people are talking about has much connection to the profound experiences that people of faith
well,
have.
Well, sure, there's only one God, one happiness, one ultimate experience, and God has many pathways. Religion is only one by which he draws people to himself, such as generous service of others, conjugal love, nature, art, creativity, science, all of these things can be paths. But religion is, as a path, is kind of concentrated, and so I think it'll continue to be a major path for a while. But nature is an equal path, if not close behind. And even the fathers of the church recognized this when they said there are two revelations. One is the Bible, the other is nature. Well, now we're in a new phase in which nature is not just looking at a beautiful sunset, but figuring out what the whole universe is about, how it's constituted, what the subatomic world is involves, and life and study of the brain, all of this stuff is really revelations about God, how this thing works. These are God's thoughts. This is the way the Creator has figured this thing out. And well, what's the matter with you folks that you can't see this?
Father Thomas Keating, talking with Steve Paulson. Father Keating was the abbot of St. Joseph's Abbey in Massachusetts, and he's the founder of the Worldwide Centering Prayer Movement. For some people, the passage of time, the sensation of every moment slipping away, heading inexorably toward old age and death, well, for some people, that sensation is terrifying. Renowned Russian classical pianist and composer Lara Auerbach wrote in her autobiographical novel, The Mirror, that she spent much of her life wishing that time didn't exist. She told Jim Fleming her fear of time began when she was still very young.
I think around the age of 6 or 7 was when the concept of time became troublesome and disturbing. Mm. That was the time when I started to realize that I imagined time as some kind of a monster that was devouring the seconds and minutes of our days and bringing us closer to the end. So around the age of 6 or 7 was when perhaps the anxiety started.
In your autobiography, you even use the word terror, I guess. In fact, would you read that little section of your autobiographical novel?
Yes, here is one excerpt where I talk about time, and this is from the novel. It's called The Mirror. In the darkness, in childhood, lying at night with eyes wide open and listening to the ticking of the clock on the wall. Second followed by second, and they knew for certain that those seconds would never return. They sunk into oblivion. Later, this terror intensified, and at the age 12, I would stop the pendulum on the wall clock. I would remove it. I would banish the clock from the room. But all the same, at night, rang out, tick-tock, tick-tock. That was my heart beating. And I had neither the strength nor the will to tear it from my breast.
It's a very real fear. In your real life, if you will, in the life that you're living, you have found ways of accommodating yourself to this, music being the main one, which is interesting in a lot of ways because music is all about time, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Music is the art of sound in time. And in a way, one may say that music is the architecture of time. And it only exists in time.
You can't hear music, you can't play music, you can't even imagine music without a sense of the time in which it is developing. And I guess what I find interesting is that with this terror of it that you had, you would find some solace in perhaps describing time with music?
Oh, absolutely. In one of my poems, I wrote that all my life is a dialogue with time. And this theme of a dialogue with time is quite apparent in both music and also in my poetry. Music is especially an extremely interesting art form because it's so connected with time and because it doesn't exist outside of time. And it also presents many curious questions. For example, in the musical composition, does the time flow from past to future? On one level, one may say that yes, that musical composition starts with the first note and it proceeds until the end. So in a way, it flows from the point A to point B while all the metamorphosis and development of the material happens. But there is also another aspect to music. And if we think of any musical composition, we in a way get an essence of the piece, which is condensed to a point. It's almost like a flash. It's the way memory works. We almost experience time vertically, where the past and future are all condensed to one singular point. And in that way, it's much closer to the way music is conceived, because when composer gets an idea of the musical composition, the details are unknown, but there is this singular point which already contains all the continuity of the musical composition. So it brings so many levels of dealing with time. For this piece, the dialogue with time, it's a rather tragic work, and the concept behind it is that there is this cage of repeated, very steady notes, and then there is a melodic material that is very human and that is in a way fighting against the gravity of this cage of steady notes. So there is this underlying tragedy and tension between something that wishes to be very free and very unconstrained, which is in a way our human nature, and something that is predetermined and is unchangeable, which is perhaps concept of time.
I wonder if you would talk a little bit about one more piece of music. Could you tell me about After the End of Time?
Yes, this piece is very much like a surreal landscape, apocalyptical nature. It's in a way my fantasy of what is it like if time no longer exists. What happens after the end, if anything? So it's a very surreal musical dream.
And non-existent time in it will not overpower us.
Hopefully.
Lara Auerbach is a classical concert pianist and composer. Her autobiographical novel is called The Mirror. And to hear more of her music, visit our website at ttbook.org. While you're there, send us a message. Your feedback matters to us. I'm Anne Strainchamps, sitting in for Jim Fleming. You're listening to the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about time and change and how our lives change over time in this hour. Sometimes, of course, it's a sudden twist of fate that sets life on a new course. For the English novelist Thomas Hardy, personal transformation and self-reinvention came with the death of his wife, Emma. His biographer, Claire Tomlin, told Steve Paulson that even though Hardy and his wife had grown apart, her death transformed the rest of his life.
It brought out his real nature as a poet. He'd always considered himself a poet. He didn't consider himself a novelist. He wrote novels, he said, to earn money. That's a little bit disingenuous because he wrote some great novels and the novels are full of poetry too. But now he was a poet and nothing but a poet. And what happened was he said he was in flower when Emma died, and he produced poems at a great rate, one after the other. And they are one of the most extraordinary collections of elegiac poems in the English language.
Well, you describe Hardy as a lover in mourning. I mean, he rediscovered how much he used to love Emma, or at least how much he imagined he used to love Emma, and he wrote an extraordinary number of poems, 80-some poems. And you call this his greatest literary achievement, better than the novels that made him famous.
Well, I accept what he said about himself, that he was primarily a poet. And I think the best of his poems are great poetry. I mean, it's a very curious career, 30 years as a novelist, establishing himself with a world reputation as a major 19th century novelist. Then he stops writing novels and he has 30 years almost in the 20th century as a 20th century poet. If you think about that, no other writer can equal that. It's so odd, isn't it? These poems about Emma concentrated his powers in the most extraordinary way. They're very daring poems. They're all written in different meters, in different rhythms. He takes a lot of risks in those poems. Some of them are very simple, and some of them are extremely complicated, romantic, melancholy, with very complicated rhythmical structures.
Can you give me a taste of perhaps one of these poems?
Well, I'll give you a taste of one of the simpler ones, because it's very beautiful and very simple, and it recalls his wooing of Emma when they fell in love in North Cornwall. It struck me that the North Cornwall coast where they fell in love has some parallels with the Pacific coast here, a great rocky, cliffy shoreline looking out west over a huge ocean with the breakers coming in and the wind coming in. There is a parallel. The poem is called "I Found Her Out There," and that's the first line. And he's remembering how he met Emma. "I found her out there on a slope few see that falls westwardly to the salt-edged air, where the ocean breaks on the purple strand and the hurricane shakes the solid land. I brought her here and have laid her to rest in a noiseless nest no sea beats near. She will never be stirred in her loamy cell by the waves long heard and loved so well. So she does not sleep by those haunted heights the Atlantic smites and the blind gales sweep, whence she often would gaze at Dundagel's famed head, while the dipping blaze dyed her face fire red, and would sigh at the tale of sunk lioness as a wind-tugged tress flapped her cheek like a flail, or listen at whiles with a thought-bound brow to the murmuring miles she is far from now. Yet her shade, maybe, will creep underground till it catch the sound of that western sea as it swells and sobs where she once domiciled and draw in its throbs with the heart of a child." I think that's a wonderful poem. It's full of the atmosphere and the colour of that landscape where he met her and which he always associated with her. And a few months after she died, he went back with his brother, revisited that part of North Cornwall, and that, of course, made him write still more poems. It was an extraordinary period. Not much notice was taken of them when they were published, because he actually published them just as the First World War was breaking out. Hmm. So they sort of disappeared in a way.
Now, to make things more complicated, there was another woman who figured prominently in Hardy's life during the last years of his marriage to Emma, this 26-year-old woman, Florence Dugdale, who was a huge admirer of Hardy's writing, and she somehow managed to insinuate herself into the lives of both Thomas Hardy and Emma to the point where they were actually competing for her attention. Can you explain what was going on?
It's one of the bits of black comedy. I mean, there is Hardy, a sublime writer, thought of as a tragic writer, and you get these moments of farce in his life. She wrote him a fan letter. She came to see him. She was very pretty. She was very charming. She was gentle. And she knew what she was doing. And he was a very, very famous writer. And they had a clandestine friendship for some time. Since Hardy and Emma were leading very separate lives, you know, it was perfectly easy for him to do this. Then she introduced herself to Emma after a few years, and Emma thought she was absolutely charming too and invited her to come and stay with them in Dorset. And you get this very curious period when Florence would go off on holiday with Emma for a week and then she would go off on holiday with Hardy. And it all got a little bit tangled. There was a glorious day when Emma said to Florence, "Don't you think Mr. Hardy looks rather like Dr. Crippen?"
Dr. Crippen, who is a murderer.
A wife murderer, yes, 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 absolutely. So then when Emma died, a further farcical situation arose. Emma had a niece called Lillian who regarded Hardy as, she called him, Uncle Daddy, and she thought she had a great claim on him. Florence, who was the same age as the niece Lillian, also thought she had a claim on Hardy, and then Hardy's younger sister Kate wanted to install a housekeeper in his house to look after him. So you had these three women. Here was Hardy going off writing his wonderful poems about Emma and really taking very little notice of them, and these three women, like three snakes, I mean, really fighting for him.
It's worth pointing out that Hardy was in his 70s at this time. I mean, he was not a young man.
No, indeed. He retained his power over women very late in life. Hardy's old age was rather serene and happy, in fact, because he became very popular with young English poets. They revered him. People came to visit him and talk to him. And he loved the country life. A lot of his poems are about the landscape, about the natural world, about animals and trees. And he's a marvellous poet of nature. He had an absolutely fixed pattern of his daily life, that he would go up every morning to his study. The fire would have been laid by the maid, and he would light it. He liked to light the fire himself, which I sympathise with. And then he'd take up his pen, and he might not write anything all morning, but he would sit there holding the pen, and he would work all day. And he kept up this regime to a month before his death. He went up his study on the 11th of December 1927 and found for the first time that he knew he couldn't write anything. And on the 11th of January 1928, he died. So there was 1 month of his life when he wasn't a writer, you know. All his life he'd written, he'd worked every day, just about.
I have to say that's a rather attractive model for what it's like to be a writer.
It's a brilliant model.
Have you tried to emulate that yourself?
I'm a woman. How can any woman be at her desk at the same time every day? I have grandchildren. I have children. I have domestic responsibilities. I have a garden. I have a husband. But I do try to work hard, yes. And I would like to go on. My husband always says that he intends to write until the day he dies. It's one of the things I really admire him for. Mm-hmm.
Could you read another one of his poems?
Another one?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, all right. Well, another Emma one.
Sure.
Well, perhaps I should read the very famous one. It's very short, called The Voice, which is quite difficult to read, but I'll try. Now, this was written in December 1912, so within a few weeks of her dying. The Voice. Woman much missed, how you call to me, saying that now you are not as you were when you had changed from the one who was all to me, but as at first, when our day was fair. Can it be you that I hear? Let me view you then, standing as when I drew near the town where you would wait for me. Yes, as I knew you then, even to the original air-blue gown. Or is it only the breeze in its listlessness, travelling across the wet mead to me here, you being ever dissolved to wan wistlessness, heard no more again, far or near? Thus I, faltering forward, leaves around me falling, wind oozing thin through the thorn from norward, and the woman calling. Oh, makes you cry, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
that is a really great poem. Yeah. Even people who don't like Hardy's poetry acknowledge that that is a great poem. In the first draft, he didn't have the original air blue gown, that blue dress she wore in summer. And you see, if you look at the manuscript, how he changes what was there and puts it in. And it's such a marvellous moment in the middle of the poem.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I find so inspiring about this story of Thomas Hardy's life is that he was 72 when Emma died. And he basically reinvented himself as a writer. I mean, this is an age when we usually think writers are, you know, they've lost their creative spark, and rarely is there great literary work at that late age. And yet, he went on to an entire second career.
Yes, he went on writing poetry and some very good poems in the very, very last year of his life. It's deeply inspiring to those of us who are also in our 70s, as my husband and I are. You think, all right, Hardy could do it. We must keep trying.
Claire Tomalin, talking with Steve Paulson about her biography of the novelist and poet Thomas Hardy. And some final reflections this hour from 92-year-old writer and former book editor Diana Athill.
The difference between being and non-being is both so abrupt and so vast that it remains shocking even though it happens to every living thing that is, was, or ever will be. What Henry James was thinking of when he called death distinguished, when it is the most commonest thing in life, I can't imagine, though the poor old man was at his last gasp when he said it, so one ought not to carp. No doubt one likes the idea of last words because they soften the shock. Given the physical nature of the act of dying, one has to suppose that most of the pithy ones are apocryphal. But still, one likes to imagine oneself signing off in a memorable way. And a reason why I've sometimes been sorry that I don't believe in God is that I shan't, in fairness, be able to quote, Dieu me pardonnerait, c'est son métier. God will forgive me. It's his job. Words which have always made me laugh, and which, besides, are wonderfully sensible. As it is, what I would like to say is, it's all right. Don't mind not knowing. And foolish though it may be, I have to confess that I still hope the occasion on which I have to say it doesn't come very soon.
That's Diana Athill, reading from her memoir Somewhere Towards the End. Athill was a legendary book editor for many years. She's 92 years old. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Jim Fleming will be back next week. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website at ttbook.org. You can also stream audio there or download a podcast. To buy a CD of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 100103A, Change Over Time. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Aaron Klum, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickard, and Mary Lou Finnegan. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and our resident technical wizard is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.